Hey there, you're listening to Unfiltered, a Case File Presents production where we invite people from all walks of life to share real stories about justice and transformation. I'm Raquel O'Brien and I'll be your host. Please join me for some raw and honest conversations. No topic is off limits. In 2019, I moved to Manaus, the capital city of Brazil's Amazonas region. If you hop on a bus from here, a 36-hour journey will take you to Caracas, the capital city of Venezuela. I hadn't been in Manaus long before I noticed an influx of Venezuelan refugees. What I didn't know at the time is that Venezuela was, and still is, experiencing what has been described as the worst economic and humanitarian crisis ever recorded in Latin America. A combination of political turmoil, inflation, soaring crime rates, and food shortages has left more than 7.71 million Venezuelans displaced since 2014. Wanting to learn more, I attended a screening of a documentary titled Salí Adelante, which translates to Moving Forward in English. The film details the health needs and challenges faced by displaced Venezuelan women and teenage girls as they attempt to rebuild their lives here in Brazil. By the time it was over, I don't think there was a dry eye in the room. The film had a profound effect on me, and I've thought about it a lot since. I was therefore thrilled when the creator and producer of Salí Adelante, Bruna Curcio, agreed to sit down with me for an unfiltered conversation in the Manaus studio. Bruna, your documentary documents what happens when women and teenage girls who are driven by necessity to leave their country arrive at a supposed safe location. We're talking specifically about Venezuelan girls and women who have migrated to the Amazon region of Brazil. Why did you choose the title?
The title actually wasn't chosen by us. It was part of the talk that we had with the women all the time. So this is something that they talk about themselves. They need to move forward. In Spanish, yo tengo que salir adelante, yo tengo que seguir, yo tengo que salir adelante, yo salí adelante. So it just made sense to use this title because it resumes what they tell to themselves every day.
Talk to me about your decision to really spotlight their voices and not try to tell their story for them.
Since the very beginning, one of the goals of this documentary was to sensibilize people and let us know who are these women that we are studying. So see them in their eyes and listen to their voices and understand that they are human beings just like us and they need our attention and they have necessities just like we do. So there is this stigma of poverty that we all share. When we see somebody asking for food in the streets or carrying their children, we don't really know what's going on with them. So when you have like products from research project, they are usually papers. They're usually letters and numbers. So it won't be empathetic, touched by this kind of material. So the main goal of this documentary was to get people emotionally touched. And so that's why we put the women, their faces and their voices to be heard.
And it's such an important issue to touch on because I think, as we were saying before, over 7 million Venezuelans have been affected by displacement globally. A lot of these people are moving into South American countries. Brazil has received a lot and they're coming through the Amazon region in general, right?
Yes, not only to Amazon. Amazon, it's in the middle of the way because the border, it's in Roraima, in the city of Pacaraima. So they first, well, people who has a better social condition actually leave first and they usually go by plane. And then as you are getting on the bottom social positions, you find people that will cross the borders by walking or by car or, you know.
And some being smuggled, I guess.
Yeah, being smuggled by trocheiros. We talk about the trocheiros in the movie because on the top of all the problems, that we still had like the pandemic situation in the middle of the migration process. So the border was closed. And so they need the smugglers because they were running from hunger. So they need to cross somehow. And they use it as smugglers for that. But then they come from Venezuela, they arrive to Boa Vista in Roraima, and then it just takes like one bus, one night driving to Manaus. And these are the main states where the federal government built up the post to receive migrants. And then from here, they are interiorized to another states. We have now like Venezuelan migrants all over the country, to be honest. And it's important because the state cannot attend so much people. The health system is already very full for Brazilians. So it's important to distribute these people. Brazil is actually a very progressist country when we talk about receiving migrants. But we are a third world country. And we have our own problems in education, security, health system. So what we can say is that we share these problems with the migrants that are coming. And it's important to know that we have problems for the Brazilian woman and also from Venezuela woman, but we are doing the best that we can.
It's so different to the reality I come from in Australia. Australia's got one of the most strict migration policies. And what they do, I don't know if you know about offshore detention. What they do is anyone who arrives by boat in Australia, they're intervened before they can arrive and they're shipped to an island called Nauru and they're held in what can only be described as like almost prison-like conditions. And they're held there involuntarily for an undefined period of time. So people are treated as criminals for trying to enter Australia. And you mentioned Brazil's third world, Australia's first world. And it's a clear message of like, you are not welcome. Brazil, as you said, created posts to receive refugees who are coming in. Can you talk a little bit about the conditions of those stations?
Well, there are like two points that it's important to touch in this receiving migrants. One is that the crisis happened while we had a very conservative government here in Brazil. And the Venezuela crisis is very related with their type of system, right? Which is a left system. So it's interesting for our government to help a country where the opposition didn't work out. The last president that we had,
President Bolsonaro.
Bolsonaro, mm-hmm. Yes. He directed funds to build up this operation. This is not a place that we can like spend a lot of time because the conditions was very precarious. It's very hard to leave your house to get in a place where you're going to share a room with hundreds of people that you don't even know. And we have all kinds of people. We have people that are there taking care of their children, kids, they cry during the night. Another people are there without any kids and they drink and they, you know, they are up all night talking. So you don't really have a limited space where you can put your routine to work and in your favor. So this is very hard. But I mean, at least we had something to receive these people. And like the main cause that they come to Brazil, it's because we have a universal health system.
Right, SUS.
Yeah, mm-hmm. SUS, which is wonderful, which is an example for the entire world because it's not a free system because we pay for the system with our taxes. So it's not right to say that, oh, this is a free system. No, it's not. We pay for it. But we pay for that. We offer that to anyone who comes here and needs medical attention. So that's why they come and why they come here. So it's hard to say like how many meals they have a day, how exactly all the rules and the routine of them inside the shelters work. But they have the chance to get their papers, their documents. They have the chance to use the health system. They have like a place to live, to take care of their children, to try to seek for a job. So it's a restart. It's a restart. The conditions are very precarious in comparison to living in your house that you build up with your family and have all the comfort that you have. But in the situation that they were, it's better than nothing. We cannot like comfort ourselves with this is better than nothing. But it's important to also look to these efforts that Brazil has done with the migrants and recognize how important it was. And of course, try to get better every time. So the laws that we have to receive migrants are actually wonderful. They give them right to education, to the health system, to, but it's important to say that the state does not generate money, right? So people need a job, they need work, they need to receive in order to reconstruct their lives.
Unfiltered will be back shortly. Thank you for supporting us by listening to this episode's sponsors. Thank you for listening to this episode's ads. By supporting our sponsors, you support Unfiltered to continue to deliver quality content. You mentioned the importance of finding jobs and generating jobs. Something that I think a lot of people who aren't aware of the situation in Brazil is that Brazil has an extremely high cost of living. So if you're earning a minimum wage in Brazil, which is 1,100 reais, that's barely enough for you to eat for the month. It's very different when you compare the minimum wage. Let's take the UK, for example, which is about 1,000 libras, 1,000 pounds a month. 1,000 pounds a month. But with 1,000 pounds a month, you actually have a quality of life that you can't afford doing the same conversion in Brazil. So when we're talking about generating jobs, a lot of these people who are earning minimum wages are not able to pay for their cost of living, the underemployment that Brazil faces. It's not just getting a job, it's getting a job that you can afford to pay for your lifestyle at the very basic level. I'm talking about supermarket costs in Brazil, the cost of products, technology products.
Yeah, even more when we are living in Manaus, which is an island.
Yes, it's an island, only accessible by boat or plane.
Yeah, exactly. And the climate here, the weather here is very extreme. It's super hot. It rains a lot. So part of the food that we consume here, they have to come from other states in Brazil. So what happens when you don't have like formal jobs for everybody? You put people in a situation that they have to go to the informal market. And when we talk about women, we talk about, when you think about like informal job, unfortunately, living in a very patriarchal system, we're talking about abuse, we're talking about violence, we're talking about rape, because this is what happens. So when it comes to women, for example, we have like a classic example here that relates with stigma. So they come with their kids, they don't have like a place in the school for their kids to study, so they don't have like free time, which is not free, but like time to go work and just like make sure that their kids are being well treated. What do? They go to the streets because they need to make money somehow. They go to the streets to ask money in the semáforos.
Yeah, the traffic lights.
The traffic lights. And then, well, first of all, there is like this reaction, this overall reaction of the population that says, oh my God, this is like bad treatment to your children. How a mother can bring
could leave
them,
their children at the traffic lights.
Can come to the sun, this kind of so hard, intense weather with these kids, with this baby to ask for money. And then there is the local council for kids, you know, they threat this woman in the streets that they're going to get their children and put in a orfanato.
Ah, they're going to take their children away and place them in an orphanage.
Yeah. So like this is a family that's being destroyed. What is better for this kid? To stay with their mom and with their brothers and sisters, even if it's in the street, but keep the family together or just separate this family. So this is very hard. Like what takes this mother to go to the street? And what should this mother do?
This is such an important point. And I think it's also important to acknowledge that in Brazil, the inequality is so stark. Just remembering this one time that someone connected to me was complaining that the Venezuelan children were putting their fingerprints on her clean car and that she would have to go and wash her car again. So it really ties back again into the importance of humanizing these stories. Otherwise, these people are just nameless and faceless and they're just a problem.
Yes, exactly.
So if we could connect that back to the documentary moving forward,
You mentioned that it's part of a research project, but I was super moved by the women who feature in the documentary and the stories they told. And I was wondering how you got access to these women and got to a point where you were interviewing them.
Well, this is a very interesting kind of technical story of the documentary, how it was made, because the documentary wasn't a goal since the very beginning. We didn't know that we were going to have a documentary as a project. And then we first had this methodology that is called Photo Voice. I had the pleasure to coordinate this methodology as well here in Manaus. So we distributed the cameras for these women in shelters. So we had access to these women basically in shelters. And because we were going to distribute cameras and we need like some kind of security and a safe place to take pictures and to use the cameras, the digital cameras, so we preferred to access these women through shelters. And also because we would have like some kind of support, people to look after their children while they were doing the workshops, which is very important. So we were in the shelters and then we gave them a workshop to learn how to use the cameras and how to build up narratives. And then we asked them to take pictures about what were their challenges in women's health, their challenge of sexual and reproductive health. We were expecting to receive pictures about, I don't know, like violence or abortion or, I don't know, what usually comes to your mind when we talk about sexual reproductive health?
Usually it's STDs and abortion, because abortion's illegal in Brazil as well. There's also that, yeah?
Yeah, it's not legal, but it happens a lot. Surprisingly, the pictures that we had the most were about caregiving. So were pictures about themselves and taking care of their children and walking and like beautiful pictures of their babies. And then the testimonials that they gave about these pictures were just like, this is my reason to keep going, to moving forward. So this was very touching. And then through these pictures, we felt the power of the photography, the images. And then we had like this different methodology that was the qualitative research. And usually in qualitative research, you do a process that's called life stories. So you do like a free interview with the person that you were studying. And this person tells you about their journey. So when we had like this material that wasn't like professionally filmed or professionally recorded in terms of audio, it was just like so rich and so touching that we said, okay, we need to do something else with that. We cannot like just have this material to analyze and be part of the qualitative method. And then we start working on this material. So all the interviews you actually see in the documentary is part of the qualitative research that wasn't filmed in a very professional way. It actually was filmed with a DSLR camera and recorded on a cell phone.
That's really interesting, because maybe that's what gave it the air of authenticity, and maybe the women felt more comfortable because they didn't feel like there was a camera crew in their face.
Yes, because the ambient of a movie set, it's
intimidating.
It's intimidating, yes. So we counted on this like lucky situation that we didn't know there was going to be a documentary. Maybe it made them much more comfortable to talk about their problems and lives. We had like very long interviews. So this is one of the things that we struggle with, cutting down until we get to 26 minutes.
So that ties into my next question. It's more about you and your role as a documentary maker, especially when you're dealing with people who are in vulnerable situations and doing your best to facilitate the telling of their stories without exploiting them in their vulnerability. I've thought a lot about it because there are so many media platforms that want to sensationalize stories of suffering for clickbait or to get people to think about the shock factor and not the human factor. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that you've thought about this question a lot internally. What are your thoughts?
Not just internally. I think about that all the time because we have to be very careful. Well, this is one of the most difficult goals on doing this documentary was like not to romanticize the suffering of this woman. We didn't want to present them as superheroes. They're like super, you know, resistant, and they have all this strength to face everything that's going on with them. No, this is not the idea. And also, we didn't want to re-victimize them, because talking about this journey is very hard. So we tried to make the process very, like, the most humanized that we could. So very personal, very patient. We still tried to have contact with these women. They have, like, our personal numbers.
Oh, I was going to ask you, do you keep in contact with them?
Yeah. Some of them, because of their change states, and then they change their phone numbers. So some of them disappear for a while. It's always a very dynamic process.
And I think that to keep in contact with the subjects is so important, because if you don't, I know I'm speaking from personal experience, when I finished the telling of my story and it was a story of abuse, and I felt like for other people involved, it was just, okay, that book's closed, on to the next. And you end up feeling like, wow, did you use me for your story? But when you can maintain that contact, it feels like it's a connection and you actually care.
Yes, because we actually do.
Yeah.
We are doing that. Like this movie was financially provided from a
you
university.
You were funded, yeah.
Yeah, it was funded from the University of Southampton, from a fund for research. So we cannot like commercialize this type of content. So the idea of producing this type of content is actually really to help somehow these people to get a better life.
Yeah.
And it's from our interest to keep having contact with them. We had like an exhibition in Manaus 2 weeks ago, which is our first screening here in Brazil. And we had like some people from Venezuela, some migrants. And after the movie, we had like this almost 2 hours of discussion. And they had the chance to speak their impressions about the movie, to give different opinions about the movie. So,
and what did you hear back from them? Share something that they...
Well, I heard all kinds of opinion. I heard a woman saying that this was very touching because it reminded her about all the hard times that they had to cross and come to Brazil. We had another one that said that she came here from another way, and we couldn't actually portray it, all the migrants in that like very suffering way. And then we had like this discussion saying, I'm very glad, because she's building up her own company. So she has her business now and she's in another situation. And she was like very bothered that we were portraying all the Venezuelan women that way. And we actually had a chance to explain that we felt so good for her that she actually had the opportunity to come in a different condition. But we were trying to bring visibility to those that did not have this opportunity. And it was okay, you know? So we had this chance to listen to their feedback. Some people who liked it, some people didn't like much. And this is important. This is the goal of the movie. The movie is a tool. It's a tool to bring awareness. Is it to bring discussions? Is it to ask you, how do I feel about that? I think I felt like very grateful for the exhibition that we had here in Manaus, because we had all kinds of people. The discussion was very rich, and it's not cool when everybody loves a lot what you do.
And I feel like if people care, they're going to give you an opinion. If they don't care, they'll just say, oh yeah, that was fine.
Yes. So I also had like the feedback, like that, and then I share this opinion. I'm constantly struggling and thinking about that.
The white savior complex. Okay, let's talk about that.
We have this in the documentary because all the researchers that talk, they are all white and they all share like a very good social condition. They are all researching about problems that they actually don't have. It's interesting because Pia and Natalia, they both are migrants. They live in UK, and they are researchers from the University of Southampton.
I'm fascinated by this. It's like our place, you and I are both white women, so our place in the telling of these stories and maybe what you do to always keep yourself in check and make sure that you're not becoming a savior. Do you do a lot of research? Do you listen to a lot of people of colored voices? Like, what do you do to ensure that you're not harmful and you're being beneficial in these spaces?
Well, we try to be a tool for their voices. Because sometimes, that said, like, how do we access the founds of the university? If you are in displacement, you have more to care about. You are not like doing a research project. In my personal opinion for my life, because my life, it's producing movies, and I believe in movies as I told you, tools for make this world better. We gotta be very consciousness that we are privileged. So I was born in a family that gave me condition to study. I never in my life worried about what we're going to eat. There was always food. So I grew up in this very privileged family and social condition. So my role in this world is to be a voice and to worry about people who do not have the same social condition that I have, the lucky, because it's just about lucky. I was born in a family that had this condition. It's not something that I had to fight for. So my role in this world is to give voice and to put our attention and to raise awareness about who needs our help, because we do not have to worry about food, healthcare system, none of that. So what do we have to worry about? No, this is the question. Like,
you can't actually avoid the reality unless you choose to avoid the reality.
Yes. And this is very hard because in the same time, it's not possible to help everybody. I get very emotional, even more after I have my daughter. She's 5 now. But then when I learned what is to be a mom, every time that I see a mom with a baby or something like that, I get very emotional.
Especially, as you said, when they're stuck on the corner at a traffic light with a baby in their arms. Because this is what it's like, a baby in their arms and 3 more kids that are in the traffic lights and they're being ignored. A lot of times their existence is ignored. People don't even acknowledge that these people exist a lot of the time. You see that happening.
Yeah.
And it's devastating. And I guess it brings back to what was so surprising, I guess, for you when you were asking about health challenges and concerns, that the number one was caregiving, that they could be present mothers and to give their children a better situation than they were in. These types of stories for me, stories of adversity, I always learn so much about the human spirit. And I'm not saying superheroes, I'm talking about the human spirit.
Resilience.
Resilience.
This is a little bit of makes me not so devastated. I'm sorry for getting so emotional. Because we need to be strategic, you know, on how are we going to touch people who actually has the power to build up some like public politics or public actions to help the biggest number of the people that we can at once. Because I am one person. I cannot help one by one. It's impossible. I won't do like a big difference. But if I can, and somehow like with a movie, or like with exhibitions or discussing xenophobia or discussing poverty stigma, things like that in public media, I can achieve a big number of people and actually help these people somehow like in a better way than just like give them one meal today because this is what I have conditioned to do, you know?
And it becomes about community organization. How can you rally people together for a common goal? And that's with government, but also with organizations. With this specific documentary, have you been in talks with government bodies or corporations about what can come after the telling of this story?
Yes, yes. We've been working in partnership with these organizations and governments since the very beginning. To access these women, this entire situation, we had to work as a team. So we have like all these ONGs and Caritas, civil organizations that are in contact with the project. They were all here for the exhibition of the documentary. And before the exhibition of the documentary, we had like 2 days of exhibition of the results of the research and discussing what can be done next to make this their lives better. And then after the exhibition here in Manaus, we had an exhibition in Brasilia, the capital of Brazil. In Brasilia, the exhibition had a different public than here in Manaus, because here in Manaus, we have like people that are in the front, in direct contact with the migrants. And in Brasilia, we have the policymaker. They direct the money, they think about the laws, they think about how the operation is going to happen. So, and then I had like this entire day explaining the results of the research. But after that, we had a very strategic meeting with the some secretaries and people who were acting in this dynamic to think about new policies and actually bring to action this entire research. It's not about just like showing the results, but how are we going to transform the reality?
If we take the title and call it Moving Forward, moving forward for you, what are your next steps?
I'm not sure. You know, I think I need some time to put my stuff together.
I think it's important to take time.
Yeah, I need to breathe. I have so many projects that I want to do, but it requires a lot of us to be involved with all of that emotionally, physically.
Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for sharing a little bit about what's happening with the refugee crisis in Brazil, with Venezuelan, specifically women and children who are migrating and all of the challenges they're facing. I've learned a lot today, so I'm sure that those who are listening will also have learned something.
Yes, thank you. It was a big pleasure to be here and to have like a chance to talk and be heard. I think this is the most important, is talk about things that matter. And being heard.
And storytelling, as you said, it's such an important tool in the humanization of people's experiences. Because unless we're hearing these stories from the voices of who it's affecting, we're doing an injustice to storytelling. We're staying in theory and we need reality. You know, these people know what they're going through better than you and I do.
Of course.
So platform their voices. So thank you for doing that.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Unfiltered. You can find the link to Bruna's documentary, Sali Adelante, in our show notes.